I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Can we hack our way back to government that works and democracy we believe in? The Watergate scandal that forced a president to quit 40 summers ago drove people's confidence in the government down to 36%. Today, it is 13%. Seriously, people, when do we stop calling it democracy when we know by now it's some mix of oligarchy, meaning rule by the few, and plutocracy, meaning the few with pots and pots of money? Hacking democracy is different from reforming it. It's more experimental. It starts with diagnosis, but it doesn't require anyone's permission or media support. It takes simple questions, then bold strokes. What if every vote in a presidential race had to count? What if interested money got flooded out by citizen money? What if outsiders learned how to run for office? Our guests this hour are three cheerful practitioners of the hacking cure for broken politics. One is a candidate, one's a writer, one's a lawyer. Law professor at Harvard, in fact, Lawrence Lessig, joined us last winter from the snows of New Hampshire to talk about his citizens' rebellion against the tiny circle of giant funders of our political campaigns. Larry Lessig has raised $12 million since then toward electing candidates who will restore public funding of politics. Hendrik Hertzberg is the E.B. White of our time, the New Yorker magazine's Talk of the Town writer, who's on a mission now to break up the Electoral College to let people's votes elect the president directly. We'll start with Zephyr Teachout, a professional citizen and Fordham law professor in the first political race of her 40-some years. She's running hard against the mighty governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, in the Democratic primary next Tuesday. But first, for context, here are the voices of people on Boston Common this week. We ask them, is your democracy working?
It depends. In some places, it works very well. In smaller community government circumstances, it works terrifically.
Special interests, conflict, people can't get along. You know, members of Congress used to talk to each other. They don't anymore. It's really sad.
Most people are relatively comfortable with the system, and that's a good thing. You know, low voter turnout. I say it's because voters aren't that unhappy with things to come out and change them.
I think the pervasiveness of money in politics can be very disempowering to people, and I think in that sense it's not working. I vote, so I feel like I've made my voice heard. Whoever I vote for doesn't always win, but I feel like I've had a say in the system.
No, it's not working, and I think once people get in there, their votes to get them into office are forgotten about, and it's politics as usual.
I am unbelievably optimistic. This is, you know, a great form of government. It keeps on challenging itself, and I do think that as the gap between the rich and the poor widens out further, before long, we will have a true revival of the 1960s. In other words, you know, people actually standing up for their rights.
I guess there's hope, but until there's a revolution, you know, history does repeat itself.
Zephyr Teachout, welcome to Open Source. I remember
well, thank you so much for having me and for sharing all those voices. Every single person who spoke, I agreed with. Is that possible?
You sound like a politician.
But it was that sense of, you know, when you care so much about a democracy and you have all these different seemingly competing thoughts. It was a very beautiful collage there. Thank you.
Funny, I listened to it, Zephyr, and I thought, those are the voices that Zephyr Teachout is hearing 18 hours a day, and they're wonderful. But let me just say, I remember you well as the chief blogger of the Howard Dean campaign for president 10 years ago. For me, you were the soul of that campaign. We knew you then as a high school track star from Vermont who went to Yale and then law school. Just remind us how the citizen became the candidate.
Well, I was approached, and I've been teaching law for the last 5 years, and since I initially met you, I've done a whole series of things. I was the national director of the Sunlight Foundation and started a nonprofit dedicated to breaking up big banks. And
I see you shattered all those banks. They're just in pieces now, right?
So I was approached in March by some Democrats and Working Families Party members, which is a party in New York, to see if I would consider challenging Governor Andrew Cuomo. And I took the question very seriously, and I came back and said, yes, I want to do it, but I want to do it if there's if we're very clear that I'm running, understanding that I'm a long shot, but running to try to win, because that's important to me. And ever since then, I've been, and we spent about a month preparing, and then I announced my candidacy, and we have been running ever since then, and there's been an extraordinary amount of momentum and excitement. At first, a lot of people came to me because they're just unhappy. Hmm. They were unhappy about Andrew Cuomo and unhappy about, he picked as his lieutenant governor somebody who's pretty right-wing for the Democratic state of New York. Unhappy about his policies. He's basically, his policies tend to be a lot more like Reagan's in economic policy. But in the recent weeks, we've seen a real change. You know, you're talking about hacking democracy, and it's an important moment, I think, in any campaign that makes it possible for it to really take off. And the change is that now people are excited about what is possible, and you get so much more energy when there's a little bit of hope inflected in that anger.
Zephyr, you're publishing a provocative book, which I've read fast, called Corruption, independent of the campaign. And we know that the campaign is not just a way to sell books. But the thread of your book...
Unlike most politicians, this is an academic. I mean, I hope people read it. It's also a popular book, but it's about the history of corruption. I certainly was not writing it as part of my campaign.
Well, no, but it has a very pointed theory or argument, should we say, about the blatant purchase of policy and politicians, which has become a rotten, entirely rotten, but generally legal practice in our politics.
Yeah,
how
right.
do you apply that argument in your race against Andrew Cuomo and to the shall we say, parlous state of New York politics these days?
Yeah, no, I mean, the book is a history book, and unfortunately, I see so much happening in New York that reminds me of the things that the framers of the Constitution saw in England when they were drafting our new Constitution. We're not that bad, but there's just so many features that are similar. I'll tell you one of them. One of them is I have a extended discussion of this thing that they used to call in the 18th century the problem of placemen. And a placeman was a person in Parliament who, because they were in an appointed office or sinecure by the king, they wouldn't be representing their constituency. They would be representing the king. So they were financially dependent on the king and stopped listening to their own constituents. So unfortunately, in New York, we have the most powerful governor of any of the 50 states, and I talked to a handful of politicians today who told me, I support you, but I can't support you openly. I'm going to have to support Andrew Cuomo because I need X or Y for my constituents in terms of funding or this or that, or my own funding depends on it. And so instead of, again, of speaking their mind and being independent, they were in some ways the modern placemen and women of New York. And it comes from the concentrated power we see there. But it's also, let's just be honest, the core problem is money in politics. I mean, that's the root issue, is that too much private money is taking over our democracy.
Was it in your book or some?
It doesn't have to be that way.
Someplace, maybe your book. I just read that $1 billion gets spent every 4 years. $1 billion in private money, either on politicians or on lobbying in one state in this great union. I mean, how can this be?
Yeah, and you know, it's the nice thing about it. And Larry Lessig, I'm so thrilled he's going to be on the program. The nice thing about it is that we actually can fix this. We know that we can. You know, never perfectly. If you study corruption long enough, or democracy long enough, you know that you can't be aiming for perfection. But you certainly can get away from this real buying of our democracy by outside interests. And to me, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book and I care a great deal about is that we have to talk about it not just in terms of illegal, you know, bribery, but understand that corruption is a very powerful political term. And when you have a corrupt system, you have a system where most of the public actors in it are serving themselves instead of serving the broader public interest.
But your history.
And that's what I see in New York, is that, you know, that public figures are not actually waking up in the morning and trying their best to, you know, serve the broader public.
Your history, therefore, though, argues that Americans have a kind of peculiarly fussy smell test for these things. We don't like placemen. We don't like bought politics. What has gone wrong in the modern history of the game?
Well, so much of it, unfortunately, comes down to the Supreme Court. You know,
this sort of Supreme amazing, Court.
But this Supreme Court, although you started to see some seeds in 1976, 200 years into this country, was the year that Buckley versus Valeo was decided. That's the Supreme Court decision that struck down some provisions of campaign finance laws. And that was at the time.
Money is just political speech.
Yes, exactly. It was such a central mistake, and that mistake, like a little seed, has grown and grown and grown and become, you know, a tragedy, you know, mistake to a tragedy.
Let me just say, and sort of tribute to campaign, you have raised hopes. You pushed the New York Times to stay out of this race, even with Cuomo in it.
We had another New York Times editorial today. We've had three New York Times editorials about our race.
They won't endorse you yet, but they've endorsed your running mate. This is really sort of interesting. I mean, I think you've frozen the linebackers here. I mean, they don't know quite what to make of you. At the same time, you've dramatized, to me, a tremendous decline of everything in New York. I mean, the governor's office of New York, this was Franklin Roosevelt's launching pad.
Yeah.
Avril Harriman's office, Nelson Rockefeller's office, Mario Cuomo's office, the forgettable George Pataki and Eliot Spitzer we'll leave aside. But New York politics is an open cesspool.
How do you turn that around?
Well,
there's so many different things you get from history. And I'll tell you, one of the things is that the end of the story is never written, and we got out of 1900. You know, one of the most hopeful ideas that I carry around in my head on disappointing days, and we haven't had very many disappointing days on this campaign, is think about what it was like to be an American in 1900. You know, here we'd fought the Civil War, and African Americans couldn't vote.
Zephyr Teachout is the out-of-nowhere candidate for governor of New York. She's modeling the hacker's way to break out of the catatonic mindset of 2014. Hacking is not typically running for office. Coming up, alternative models in law professor Lawrence Lessig and the New Yorker wise man Hendrik Hertzberg. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Our guest, Lawrence Lessig, is the Harvard Law School advocate for the free internet before the Supreme Court and elsewhere in important books. The deep scourge of our politics, he'll tell you, is private money. So he and his Mayday pack raised a lot of money this year for congressional candidates who will vote for public funding instead. Raising money to break the grip of money, Larry Lessig, sounds like trying to drink yourself sober, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, it does. And so we can be ironic and celebrate the irony because that gets people focused for a moment. But if you think of the history of reform, it's always been the case people have used the existing unjust system to produce a more just system. So when women were granted the right to vote in 1920, finally, it was a bunch of men who got together and voted to make it possible for women to vote. And you wouldn't have complained and said, geez, it's only men. We can't use just men. You would say, this is how we achieve a more perfect union, as the Constitution.
What's your test of the candidates you support? What do they have to promise? And then how do you get them to keep it?
Well, right now in this cycle, what we're trying to show is that Americans care enough about this issue to vote for it. So this is really a pilot race in eight different districts, where we're going to rally people to vote on the basis of this issue so we can break this kind of mentality that exists among the political class that Americans don't care about this issue. They don't care about corruption. If we can show that they will vote on the basis of this issue and build the data necessary to see how much it will take to actually win a Congress committed to reform, mm-hmm. I believe we can raise the money in 2016 to run a race that will win a Congress committed to reform and give the next president a Congress that has voted to eliminate the way money infects decisions in Congress.
Just remind us of how we got here. I mean, Ronald Reagan was elected twice with public funding.
Yeah.
I mean, John McCain, you know, as conservative, you know, sponsored McCain-Feingold rather radical reform on this subject. How do you make it a consensus issue?
Yes, it's got to be a cross-partisan issue. And you're right. People forget Ronald Reagan ran three national campaigns on the public fisc, right? He would never have been even considered in 1976 had it not been for public funding, because the Republican Party was not going to support what they viewed as a far-right character. And when he ran for re-election in 1984, he attended 8 fundraisers. Barack Obama, when he ran for re-election, attended 228 fundraisers. Mm. Now, what's astonishing is we forget that between Nixon and Obama, every single president was elected with public funding. Like, in that world, they didn't spend all of their time focused obsessively on raising money from this tiny fraction of the 1%.
Barack the Obama White House spends all its time writing to me for money.
Yeah.
Can you imagine?
Yeah, it's not just you, Chris, but it turns out... Yeah, and this is the thing. It's not just it's not just the president, it's Congress. These people spend 30 to 70% of their time raising money. There's a leaked memo from Michelle Nunn, who's running for Senate in Georgia, a wonderful Democrat running for senator. She was advised to spend 80% of her time raising money. And the memo went through the position she needed to take to raise the money from the various interests she would have to be raising the money from. We have created this monster of people obsessively focused on the tiniest fraction of the 1%. And is there any surprise then that we have a government that most people think is just not responsive to any of us?
Zephyr Teachout, how much time in your day do you spend raising money?
Well, for about a month after I started the campaign, we dedicated 40 hours a week to raising money. I'm not saying we did that every week, but that was our campaign target.
You and how many people?
Oh, me personally. So we can do online fundraising, which is great, but me personally sitting down with a list of names, calling, saying hello, talking to people that I know, people that I don't know, and asking them to make a contribution. And it is extremely, well, it's difficult in an interesting way. It's difficult because it feels like it isn't what you think you should be doing when you run for public office. It doesn't feel like that's what you sign up for. You know, I'm not out there listening to people who are struggling with dental care or learning about, you know, what are the precise problems with small businesses in Jackson Heights. You know, that feels like what I should be doing. That's also hard work. But this kind of work feels so disconnected from what the job of a politician should do, that in itself is painful. And, you know, I thought very often about how different it would be if we had a public financing system in New York State, because, well, if I could raise $1,000 from talking to 2 or 3 people, well, then I would always, because of a multiple matching system where if I raise $100, I could get $600 from the state, I would be spending all my time talking to everybody, listening to everybody and learning. And instead, because we don't have a matching system, my job is to make lists of the wealthiest people I know. Now, we've been lucky and we've gotten a lot of grassroots support, including generous support from Larry Lessig in his words, telling people that this was an important race. But I will tell you, the experience of going through that does not feel like what politics and representation feels like.
How does the governor of New York avoid having a public debate with you on television, or 5 of them?
Well, he keeps trying to avoid it. And yesterday he actually called it a disservice to democracy in times to debate. So he's sort of tying himself up in knots because he's got that upside down. And I think people are, not I think, we know that people really want to debate. And every time he refuses to debate me, it actually calls more attention to the fact that there's something interesting happening in New York State. There's something worthy of debate. Why is he avoiding this? What does he have to hide?
Larry Lessig, aren't we all struck by the way this system demeans the players? It's awful what it does to these people in front of our eyes.
Yeah, and what's striking is that many of the people on Capitol Hill don't even realize that it hasn't always been like this. You know, there was a time not that long ago, I think this problem really kicks off in the middle of the 1990s. Before that, you know, there was a time when you would govern and there would be a time when you would campaign. And during the time when you would govern, you know, think of the Reagan years when the most important deals were struck between Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan, right, and they got stuff done. But then you would go into campaign time and maybe your life would be like this. But now we have permanent war. It's constant campaigning. I met a guy after the last election who said, you know, when I ran for Congress, he came from California, he said, I spent my whole campaign in my pajamas. And I thought, okay, this guy's from California. That's just the way they are. But no, he said, I literally just sat at home calling people all the time. That's all I did. And then we gave that money to the television stations and they ran the commercials. But he said, now that I've come to Washington, it turns out my job is not very different. The only difference is I can't wear my pajamas anymore, right? And you look at these people and you feel so sorry for them because they don't actually get to do anything anymore. There's no legislation they get to pass. They have this ridiculous life of just screaming at the other side, creating partisan war. And they spend 30 to 70% of their time on the phone raising money from people, the tiniest fraction of the 1%.
Among the hackers of government and politics, I want to introduce Rick Hertzberg. He was Jimmy Carter's chief speechwriter once upon a time. And at the front of the New Yorker magazine, he is the beloved editorialist for years now on politics in general, but especially on the distortions in our voting system. Rick introduced the idea of direct voting as one hacker's notion of a cure. And then we got to make the money connection with what you're talking about, too. But give us the sermon, the short one, on direct voting for president.
Well, it is possible to... the Electoral College is not a problem. The problem really is the winner-take-all aspect of the Electoral College in 48 of the 50 states. And what that means is that the country is divided between a handful, just 10, 9 or 10 battleground states, and then 50 or 40 or 41 states that are politically dead during the general election campaign. Mm. Now, without changing the Constitution, we can do something about this, and we're halfway to doing something about it.
Who's we? And show us the landmarks here.
We as the state legislatures of the United States. The only thing the Constitution says about choosing the president is that each state will appoint, not elect, appoint a number of electors according to the procedure established by the legislature of that state. Now, in all but a couple of states, the legislature has decided to give all the electoral votes of that state to whoever wins the popular vote in that state. But if the legislatures decide instead that they'll give all their electoral votes to the candidate who wins in all 50 states, you've got a different ballgame. And that's what's going on. There's an interstate compact that is halfway to reaching the needed 270 electoral votes, which says when enough states have signed up to this agreement, we, the compacting states, will give all our electoral votes to who wins in the entire country. And at that point, every vote will count the same. No more battleground states, no more spectator states. Every vote in the country worth going after, every vote in the country worth campaigning for, grassroots politics being worth doing in every corner of the country.
And not to mention no more loser winners of the presidency. In other words, you lost, but you won.
That's right. We've had 38 people elected president in the history of this country. Four were elected while coming in second in the popular vote. That's better than 10%. This is not such a rare thing. But still, 90% of the time, the person with the most votes does win. But what happens 100% of the time is that your vote doesn't count unless you live in a battleground state. And that's just wrong, and it's not in the Constitution, and we can do something about it without changing the Constitution.
By simply agreeing that the electoral votes will go to the man or woman who won the most votes.
But if enough states say they'll do that, as soon as enough states have signed on to create a majority in the Electoral College, presto, change up. Then it doesn't matter whether you live in a state that's signed on to this or not. Right. The only thing that counts is who gets the most votes in the whole country. And Chris, you asked me to tie that in with money.
Please, that's the question.
One way it ties in with money is this. There's a limit to how much money can be raised. no campaign, no presidential campaign has ever said, oh, we've raised enough money, let's not bother raising any more. But there is no limit to grassroots politics. And all that money, even if somewhat more money is raised under a 50-state election, it's got to be spread out. Right now, you can raise the money in a few places, but then it can be funneled into these battleground states where it has much higher impact and where it just crushes grassroots politics. But if you got to spread the money all over the country, it's not going to have that kind of impact.
Interesting. Larry Lessig. Critique the Hertzberg reform.
So I love the Hertzberg reform. I think absolutely this is a change we have to have. But I think about the sequence of reforms, because though I agree there's going to be a limit to how much money you can raise, if all of a sudden we had 50 battleground, well, we wouldn't have 50 battleground states. We'd have maybe 45 or something like that.
But we'd have one battleground country.
We'd have one battleground country, but you'd be running in many more districts around the country. And the point is that if we increase significantly the cost of campaigns, and we haven't changed the way we're funding campaigns, we've just further increased the power of the tiny slice of people who are now funding campaigns. So I completely support the idea about changing the way we elect the president. And this is a beautiful hack. It is the definition of a hack. But I think we need to move a number of reforms at the same time and to get back to the place where we recognize that private funding of public campaigns produces perpetual corruption in the way our government works.
Rick, you want to bless that thought? And I'll have a little pushback.
I'll bless every part of it except the idea that it would be worse with a 50-state or one-country campaign. Larry, what do you think of the reasoning that I laid out, that if this money has to be spread out over the whole country, it's going to be relatively less important than other aspects of the campaign, such as organizing, grassroots.
So this is a great point to focus on a distinction between the two different things people sometimes are worried about. Sometimes people are worried about how campaign money is spent. I'm not worried about how campaign money is spent. I'm worrying about how campaign money is raised. And if the change increases the cost of campaigns, but we haven't changed the way money is raised, I believe that what you'll see is presidential candidates not spending 228 times during a reelection cycle going to fundraisers. They'll be spending 400 times going to fundraisers, and it will still be the fundraisers of the tiniest fraction of the 1%. And now that the super PAC system for funding campaigns has become the norm, it'll be an increasingly small number of people who are in the position to be funding these campaigns and getting the favors in exchange for their funds.
Rick Hertzberg, I want to push back in this form. I love the idea of hacking, sort of a redesign, improvement in the structure. And I think it is connected to money. But I also got to ask you, as a prominent, eminent Obama guy, a real rooter, would we be talking about these structural issues if the charisma, the magic, the promise of Barack Obama had held? I mean, what is the importance of men here as opposed to measures, just the personalities?
Much less than you think, Chris. Yes, I've been talking about it since long before I'd ever heard of Barack Obama. And I think that there's a cult of the presidency here.
Yep.
People do not run for, Obama did not run for president saying, if you elect me, we'll make a marginal improvement in our healthcare system. It won't be great, it won't be perfect, but it'll be okay. When you run for president, you have really no choice but to feed this myth of an all-powerful presidency. I look at Obama's leadership, just sort of turn it a quarter angle here and look at it in a different way. Yes, I do think that his presidency has led to a greater understanding of the structural problems of our democracy, and I think that's good. I think that he does understand these structural problems. He's tried to make it clear that he understands them, and I think we can see that the superior achievements of Lyndon Johnson over leaving aside the Vietnam War, of course, but over Barack Obama, is largely a function of structure. Yeah, LBJ was great at jawboning and talking on the phone to Everett Dirksen, but as soon as he lost his filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, as soon as he didn't have that big, huge congressional majority, he didn't get anything done either. So I really think that this leadership, the whole leadership cult is a mistake, except possibly in New York, where we have a very powerful governor, and I'm looking forward to voting for Zephyr next Tuesday.
You were just going to say, Zephyr. Go, your turn.
Just listening to you. Thank you, Rick and Larry. I listening to you, I was thinking about how, you know, in 2008 we had this crumbling of the financial sector with such terrible effects because banks had become too big to fail and so fragile in the way that when power gets concentrated, it also becomes fragile. And that's certainly what I feel in New York, but I feel in a whole bunch of our systems, there's actually a great opportunity for change because the fragility of the system is showing because it's not working in some way. Like the hours in the pajamas is not working, and the cult of personality isn't working, and there's this moment of fissure and opportunity, and I think that's actually very exciting. It's just that we have to seize it.
To me, this question of why we pragmatic Americans are more sensitive about results, why we don't ask every day, is it working, is a puzzle. Maybe we'll get to it. We're trying to revive the pulse of politics by hacking the system on open source. Coming up, can the disease be as bad as we, the doctors, are saying it is? I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're hacking government this hour with law professor Lawrence Lessig, with the New Yorker pundit Rick Hertzberg, and with the citizen candidate for governor of New York, Zephyr Teachout. Match our mood with the words here of Theodore Roosevelt. By the time of this recording in 1912, he was a former Republican president running again as a bull moose progressive.
These men, the big bosses of the political field, the beneficiaries of privilege in the field of industry, the men who represent that sinister alliance between crooked politics and crooked business, which has done more than anything else for the corruption of American life, are united as one man against the genuine rule of the people themselves.
That was Teddy Roosevelt, 1912. Larry Lessig, Rick Hertzberg, Zephyr Teachout. How much hope do we feel that we're anywhere near a new progressive movement in this country? Start with you, Zephyr, please.
I feel an extraordinary hope. I mean, just personally looking at the response to my campaign has been overwhelming. And I love hearing Teddy Roosevelt speak because that language, that same set could be said right now and you'd get a room of people standing up and cheering because that's how they're experiencing their world. But I'm hoping that my campaign, you know, fundamentally running for office is the ultimate hack, of course. and I'm hoping that our campaign, my campaign with Tim Wu, leads to hundreds and thousands of more people to realize that there's these extraordinary cracks in the system and opportunities and so much to be gained and so little to lose.
Larry Lessig, can you explain to Zephyr Teachout, whom we'd all love to have as governor, why she's probably not going to win the Democratic primary? What's our attachment to the bad meaning of hacks?
Well, no, I'm not going to explain that because I'm not there yet. I'm optimistic about this, but I think we have to recognize what are our structural constraints. Back to what Rick was talking about, and one of them was very important difference between the progressives and our time is that, and the progressives were just discovering the power of investigative journalism. And America was just beginning to pay attention to it. And the journalists took their job seriously to explain the facts to America. And America was shocked. This is Doris Kearns Goodwin's, you know, really fantastic book, The Bully Pulpit, that brings this out. And there was an opportunity for people like Teddy Roosevelt to leverage his close connection with the press to get the people to understand what was going on. Today we live in a world where there is no such press. There is no opportunity to speak across political ideology. It's Fox News or MSNBC. NPR tries to do its job, but even there, it's limited in what it can really take on here. And we don't even have the recognition that the job of the press is to be engaged in politics, too, by telling us the truth and then having a result as a function of that. That, you know, the progressive press would bring out an article to tell the truth about a candidate before an election so that that candidate would be defeated because the facts said that that candidate should be defeated. Now we have the New York Times that believes it should not tell us the truth about what George Bush did in Iraq before the election for fear that they might interfere with the election. It's a complete reversal of the role of the press in helping us to understand this democracy. And that's, I think, much more challenging than imagining people like Zephyr Teachout winning in office.
Does this indictment of the press ring true to you, Rick? I'm not so sure.
It doesn't particularly ring true to me, no. And similar to the indictment of politicians per se, I think that one of the reasons that we take such a moralistic view of politics and why we so often fault leadership as the problem is that so many of our problems are really baked into our Constitution, not just the written Constitution, but the unwritten Constitution. And we don't want to question that. We don't want to say that the founding fathers got it wrong. And indeed, they didn't get it wrong. What they came up with was absolute gorgeous, you know, Silicon Valley state-of-the-art representative republic politics for 1789. But it's not 1789 anymore. Mm. And we have to look at this structure critically and at the very least understand the ways in which it hobbles us and hobbles our democracy. And this goes from top to bottom. I think Zephyr mentioned earlier that the problem of money in politics had become hugely worse because of the Supreme Court. And the particular Supreme Court we have now is a product of the 2000 election. And the 2000 election is a product of the presidential election system that we have now, the Electoral College status quo. If we didn't have that, we wouldn't have this Supreme Court. We'd have a 5-4 Supreme Court or a 6-3 Supreme Court that was deciding these questions the other way. This is true from top to bottom. We have a Congress, we have a House of Representatives where the majority of voters have voted for one party and the House is controlled by the other party. And we have a Senate where senators representing 15 or 20% of the American people can stop any kind of legislation at all.
Rick, let me just say, I admire you so for a line you dropped, that it's time to think anew like the founding fathers instead of worshiping them.
That's right.
Where would you begin? Give us three starting points.
I'd begin with, if I were going to rewrite the Constitution, I would either abolish the Senate or make it elected by proportional representation.
Ooh.
For the whole country. I would have multi-member districts for the House so that we wouldn't have these great. Right now, the House is even more politically dead in a sense than the presidency, because there are fewer than 10% of these 435 districts are competitive. The rest are foregone conclusions. The elections there are essentially meaningless.
You're a bolder hacker than I realized, Rick. Larry, quick critique, and I want yours too, Zephyr.
Well, I mean, obviously, we each start from a different place. I would start by changing the way we fund elections. I would mandate that we change the way we fund elections. It's not that I like the presidential model for funding elections. I would much more rather have something like everybody has a voucher that they can use to help fund elections or matching funds like New York does. But we've got to have a way to bring people into the process of funding elections just as importantly as they are in the process or supposed to be in the process of electing people once we have an actual election. That, I think, is a core problem that blocks a whole bunch of other reforms, too. Many of the reforms that Rick are talking about, I would be totally supportive of. But again, the sequence of this reform, I think, is critical.
How do you get that done, Larry, without a change in the Supreme Court?
Well, because the voucher proposal or the matching fund proposal is perfectly constitutional under this Supreme Court's jurisprudence. It's not about restricting speech. It's about enabling more speech. And the one place that they've struck this back was a stupid decision, the Arizona decision, but it was because they interpreted a particular incentive structure to be restricting speech. They were wrong, but the point is they have again and again said you could fund elections in publicly. You can fund it by giving people vouchers. You should fund it by matching funds. And that would be an alternative that doesn't get close to the Supreme Court.
Zephyr Teachout, think like a founder. Rebalance the system.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key thing we need to do is change the way we fund elections also. Along with Larry, it's pretty clear that that's constitutional under the existing system. But certainly if we were going to be going back to basics, I think that's the basic issue, because we've spent over 200 years struggling with the problem of money in politics, and the default response has been to ban things that aren't working, but not to build systems that do work. But in the long term, if we want representative government, and that is the core idea, and that's certainly the core idea that Rick is talking about. I mean, there's a deep similarity, which is with both the way the Electoral College works now and the way the funding works now. Millions of people are considered politically dead, as Rick said, and they aren't politically dead. Everybody deserves equal political dignity. So instead of just banning things, we have to really build this new way that people can represent their constituencies and not become so dependent on a handful of wealthy interests. And to me, that's public financing of some form. I like the voucher system as well.
I'd ask you all to just stand way back and explain the numbers, which are, to me, confounding. At the beginning, as I noted, confidence in government in the worst moments of Watergate was down to 36%, 13% today. Gallup poll in China finds confidence in government and in Xi Jinping 92%. Putin, after the annexation of Crimea, 83% confidence. Barack Hussein Obama, confidence in his leadership, Gallup poll 42%. This summer, Gallup finds confidence in the executive branch in the United States of America 30%. Supreme Court 29%. Congress 7%. The bottom has fallen out, and it's hard to explain. It's not just public financing. They don't have public financing in China. They don't have elections. What's the disease here, Larry?
Well, I don't think we can compare those kinds of polls with China and Russia to ours. But I think it's important to understand why it's falling out in the United States. And I think it's falling out in the United States for a reason as wonderful researchers Hibbings and Tease Morris have done, to demonstrate that when American people believe that their government is acting in its own interest or the interest of its leader, you know, the members of Congress, and not in a public interest, they develop this deep cynicism and skepticism about everything it does. And I think one of the byproducts of the reality that we all see, members spending all their time raising money, kowtowing to the people who are funding campaigns, is we can't begin to understand anything Congress does or our government does without thinking in the back of our head it's because of somebody's money, even if it's not. We can't see them in acting in any way except driven in this way, and that fundamentally undermines any reason we have to have confidence in what they do. And the data supports the fact that we shouldn't have confidence in what they do, that what they are doing is responding not to what the average voter wants. There's a great report from Princeton, Martin Guilens and Ben Page, that showed that there was no statistically significant correlation at all between what our government does and the average voter, but there was a significant correlation between the economic elite and business interests. Well, who's surprised?
I'm surprised. I'm shocked.
Really?
Yes, that there is no traceable connection between public preferences and the policies that result.
Yeah, well, this is a product of a system where you force the people to spend the most of their time focused on what these tiny fraction of Americans want, the economic elite, the business interests.
So let's Xi Jinping and his handful of his friends run it all.
No.
They're not spending money on the phone raising money.
No, they're not. They've got different problems, different kind of corruption. And I do not think that's a better system. Absolutely. But I'm a big believer that we could hack this system in not revolutionary ways, but pretty important ways. I take all of Rick's changes and add to it a change that Zephyr has been talking about and I've been talking about, the way we fund elections. We'd be pretty pretty good as a democracy, something we'd be very proud of again.
Zephyr, I love your line that the running for office is the ultimate hack. I was a citizen candidate once upon a time, and I'm so glad I was. I remember people saying, who do you think you are running for mayor of Boston? But, you know, there was an answer. How do we make it easier, more inviting? How do we let people know that you don't risk your reputation or even your mortgage, your house, to run for office? Be a citizen.
Well, I may sound like a broken record here, but I'm going to say it. Once you allow for a public funding system, it totally opens up who runs. It's really a feminist issue. I think public financing is a feminist issue because you see a lot more women running for office, many more minorities, many more people with really different backgrounds, you know, waitresses, bus drivers, and that's actually the Democratic vision. And I think that's essential. Another essential part is sort of reminding ourselves of the, you know, if we are going to have take this edge of change, and we're there, I mean, you can see it with Moral Mondays in North Carolina that are spreading to other places. There's a real new moral, a powerful moment in American political life right now. And part of that is returning both moral language and a kind of sense of joy to public life, because there's an extraordinary amount of joy to be had in it.
Rick Hertzberg, before you abolish the United States Senate, why don't you run for it?
Well, if Zephyr gets elected governor, I will.
she might appoint you. No, but Zephyr, you gave a very touching little sermon right there. Sort of bring the joy, bring the fun, lower the risk, make it more common. Everybody can stand up in this church and preach for a moment. Why not?
And
Rick, I
just want to say that Larry's reform and my reform are not in competition with each other. This isn't a horse
That's
race
right.
between his and mine. Let's
right.
yoke these two horses to our chariot and go somewhere.
Absolutely. I'm with you 100%, Rick. Mm-hmm.
How long does it take to get there, Larry Lessig? How long does it take for you to build your sort of control group, make it wholesale, and change the way we feel about the whole game?
We don't have a lot of time. I mean, we've got to do it right away. If we do not change the way we fund elections, I think by the next presidential cycle, this model, this super PAC model of funding elections, becomes the dominant mode for the next chunk. And we've got to change it.
Not only that, but it becomes commonplace in conversation that we don't have a democracy anymore.
Absolutely. Yeah. I
mean, this is new. This is new within 3, 5, 7 years.
No, it's urgent.
And it can happen. It can happen quickly. Look at how quickly we adopted the secret ballot, the Australian ballot, and state after state, all of a sudden in the late 19th century, the secret ballot was very quickly adopted. So once people start to see, and they are starting to see, how essential this is, it can take over the country.
How many of your candidates have to win, Larry, and how dramatically? Will the New York Times notice? Will it be a Tea Party? What does it take to have a Tea Party effect?
Yeah, well, we don't want a Tea Party effect in 2014. I mean, what we want to do is just to demonstrate how we can do it and what it would take to do it in a national way. And then we want to turn around to people to help fund that national campaign. And we want to turn around and ask for funding from people who are burdened by the inequality of the system and by people who are benefited by the inequality of the system. Just like the civil rights movement appealed to blacks and whites to work together to achieve equality, we want to appeal to the people who now are funding the super PACs, as well as to the people who in some sense feel like there's no reason for them to vote because this system doesn't care what they care about as long as they don't have $50,000 to throw into a PAC.
I like your thought that, you know, time is running. How much lower can we go than 13% confidence in our government?
No, I mean, you know, at the time of the American Revolution, more Americans believed in the British crown than believe in our Congress today, right? So we are at this point where, what stage do you have to declare bankruptcy, political bankruptcy, for an institution? Because I don't see how much lower it could go.
This is fascinating. And I feel in Zephyr the joy in sort of reinflating the system with lots of ordinary people, not that she's ordinary, but regular people like ones we know going out there and running, even for the fun of it, even
Absolutely.
For the joy of it. To Zephyr Teachout, good luck in your primary next Tuesday.
Thank you, and thank you for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. Thank you, Lawrence Lessig. Thank you, Rick Hertzberg. Please catch up on Open Source, our three-part series on World War I and my summer trip to China in three audio postcards are all at our website. Drop us a line at radioopensource.org and subscribe to us, please, on iTunes. We send out a terrific newsletter every week, too. Our show this week was produced by Max Larkin with help from Connor Gillies and Will Freeman. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.